Today we're talking to you about politics of change in Namibia, and I'm David Preisinger. Now, let me ask, first of all, how many of you were with us when we had the discussion on apartheid? It was last week we had a discussion on apartheid. Were any of you in on that? You two were. I want to review that very briefly, and I hope that you won't mind if I do that for the benefit of the others, because when we're talking about politics in Namibia, we have to understand that social system and know at least a few of the little details about it. So I'll do that rather quickly, and you'll have a chance to ask more questions, of course, after a while, too. So apartheid, as we mentioned before, is pronounced that way to rhyme with hate. And again, that is appropriate, because apartheid, to my mind, is a patent evil, contrary to the whole Christian gospel, to the gospel of the Christian ethic of love, to the gospel of the Christian view of community. But let me tell you a little bit about that. It was in 1948, as some of you heard that in the discussion this morning, that they began to, in South Africa, began to lay out one rule after another of apartheid. Rules like voting for black people forbidden, certain kinds of work forbidden to black people and to colored people as well, forbidden for black, colored, and white to associate together in a political party or in sport or socially, forbidden by law, marriage between black and white, forbidden. That particular provision has now been lifted, and I don't know that that makes so much difference. And black people were not allowed to make moves wherever they wanted to in order to seek work. They were not allowed to live inside the cities. They had to live outside of the cities in designated areas. And this is the rules that they started to lay out then in 1948. They are not allowed to campaign or demonstrate or speak against apartheid. That's against the law to do that. They were not allowed then to form trade unions and to go on strike. Now, since that time, that must have been alleviated somewhat, because they are beginning to get a pretty strong trade union movement in South Africa now. But even now, when people go on strike, and you take in Namibia, for example, copper miners went on strike in Tsumeb, the town of Tsumeb, not too long ago. Well, about a year or two ago, I guess.
This past year.
Was it this past year? And they all got fired. The end. And then they just hired on others at the same low pay, with the same bad working conditions. And of course, black and white are supposed to use different entrances to public buildings, different public toilets. They're not allowed to use the public toilets. And elevators, they use different elevators. A lot of rather crazy stuff, actually. This all adds up to heavy oppression on the black folk. And as we talked about this last week, the oppression is first of all legislative, as I've just told you, the various laws. It is, of course, economic, because black people are not allowed to hold certain jobs that would be high, that would give a decent pay. They can only work on the lower level. The wages, in fact, in Namibia and in South Africa, the wage ratio between black and white has been variously estimated at 10 to 20 to 1. That is, for $1 that a black person gets, the white person gets $10 to $20 more in, as far as pay is concerned. One of the greatest one of the greatest oppressive features, it seems to me, of apartheid is the psychological oppression. That it says to human beings, you are not worth much. You are worth less than we are. And people begin to believe it, or they begin to feel inferior. They begin to feel, well, maybe I can't do some of these things that those smart folks can do. And some poor folk begin to feel that way. This happens. This was the same thing that was happening in the United States. And one of the first things that black leaders began to realize in the United States back in the 60s was that they had to raise the black consciousness of the people. And this was the black is beautiful kind of thing. And to do that, it had to be the black people themselves. Sometimes the so-called white liberals were probably disappointed because they might have felt rejected by the black people who were trying to get into this black consciousness movement. Same thing has been happening in South Africa, for example, too. Steve Biko, the young black leader who died at the age of 30 a few years back, was murdered in prison. He was a leader of the black consciousness movement, and he, in some of his writings, has said, we don't want to be enemies of the white liberals. We appreciate their sympathy, but this is something we have to do ourselves. And so this is the way the black consciousness movement has gone. It has to do with overcoming this psychological oppression. Okay? As I mentioned, apartheid was called heresy by the Reformed Churches Alliance of the, whatever that name is for the world. And I think I said to some of you, in my opinion, heresy is too good a word for apartheid, because heresy usually, at least historically, would indicate that there is something good that has simply gone to an extreme or gone in a wrong direction. I cannot see in the present social practice and laws of apartheid in South Africa that there's any good in them whatsoever. And yet, the thing that is so sad and that hurts you so much is that it is practiced by the Afrikaners, who claim to be deeply committed Christians. And I suppose that they, in their way, I suppose that they are, or think or feel, they do really feel that they are, and they got this horrible blind spot which prevents them from seeing the terrible human waste that they are making of millions of human beings. And that's what's so painful and hard to understand about this whole situation. By the way, as I'm talking, you want to ask questions, I hope you'll feel free to interrupt any time. It's okay with me. Anybody at the moment?
I just wondered, you said this started in 48.
That's when they started turning it into laws.
Yeah,
it was in practice already then.
Have I been in the dark, or has there been any coverage on this before, you know, recent times? Because apartheid did not come into focus for me until, probably 6-7 years ago.
Maybe. Yeah, that's probably about right. See, it wasn't a big news story then for us, probably, because we were thick in we were deep into the Jim Crow laws in our own country.
Yeah,
and
we
had our own problems. I mean, we weren't any better than they. We had no reason to brag, and it was only after the black consciousness movement in the U.S. began to take some effect. And there's a difference, of course, between the U.S. and South Africa. In the U.S., the black people had the law and the Constitution on their side. It remained for the rest of us finally to recognize this. These, go ahead.
That there were writers that were writing about, like Alan Payton, yeah, been writing right for a long time, and I think it was 20 years ago or more, his books and
a movie. I think there was a movie on it in the 50s, maybe.
Could be.
Yeah.
Cry the Beloved
Country. Yeah. Cry the Beloved Country, yeah. That must have been at least 20 or some years ago. See, I remember reading that book when it first came out, and then was it Too Early, The Fowlerel? Too Early or Too Late?
Too late
The Fowlerel was another one of Alan Payton's.
And I Thought Your Lion Is Beautiful, I think.
That's his most recent one. Alan Payton was a white South African writer. He just died a few weeks ago. I believe he died about the month of April at the age of 85. He was one of the white liberals.
It wasn't in the news and everything all the time.
No, that's right. You're right about that part. It wasn't a big newsworthy item.
It seems to me that Sharpeville was a major change in terms of global consciousness about South Africa, though. But partly because that exiled a whole series of leaders, right?
And yeah.
At least our large cities then, most of them had South African exiles around.
Yeah. And, what was the year of Sharpeville?
60, I think.
Somewhere in the 60s.
60, 61?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And then there's a bunch of things happened thereafter, mm-hmm, and are still happening every day. And now you don't hear so much about it because of the news blackout. Mm-hmm. So you don't hear much about it at all anymore. And any reporters within the country, if they report out of line or anything that isn't passed by the state censors, they'll be thrown out of the country. That's the problem they have.
Was the anti-apartheid of the total population of South Africa embraced by and large the whole population of blacks? I mean, are there some blacks who are apartheid conscious? I mean, apartheid.
Who think it's okay? You mean?
Yeah, figure it's okay.
Not really. There are some who are possibly just living with it and are not outspoken or militant.
I would disagree. I think there are some who are, for the sake of money, are going to go along with this.
Yeah, well, there are some, I was going to say, who are some who would be called collaborators.
Mm-hmm. And there's black policemen, aren't there some black security forces?
Oh, all kinds of them.
Yeah.
All kinds of them.
Yeah.
But never officers. Also in the army, the South African army, army that occupies Namibia. Many black soldiers are in there, but none of them are officers. They cannot be officers.
Well, and they're drafted probably against their own will. But some you were going to say something like that.
I think there are more people who they don't really think apartheid is right, but they don't have any choice. In order to get a job, you need to cooperate with the government, and that's the people who accept it, even though they don't. It's not right.
And they are, drafted into the military. And I mean, now I think since January, I mean, they don't have a choice. I mean, they have to go. If they don't go, they go to jail. They get out of jail and they get a choice again. If they don't want to go again, they go to jail. So,
this is in Namibia now.
Yeah.
What's the relationship between Namibia and South Africa?
The relationship is simply that Namibia was mandated to South Africa. Right after the First World War, and South Africa was supposed to nurture it to independence, because before that it was a German colony. And South Africa never did that. They just kept holding on to it and regard it now as one of their provinces. They have four provinces they regard as the fifth province of South Africa, and that's the way they use it, and exploit it for its mineral wealth, since it's very wealthy in minerals, and that's what South Africa is doing.
And it's cheap labor.
Yeah. So, and I'm going to say a little bit more about that, by the way. That's a good question, because that's where the politics of change come in. I just want to mention this yet in connection with the apartheid system there. White on top, Indians, colored, black, and then the blacks divided into tribes and set apart even in their tribes. In South Africa, the areas around the cities where black people must live are called, they call them townships. And certain areas of the country, some of the parts of the country that are not nearly as fruitful, that are dry and arid, those are set aside as homelands. And there are, I don't remember how many, I think about 8 homelands. And some of the homelands, even for certain tribes, are divided homelands. There's a piece of it here and a piece of it here, and they're not even connected. South Africa wants to say, these are independent countries. But nobody else in the whole world recognizes them. Only South Africa does this now. These are independent countries. And of course, what this is simply their way of depriving blacks of citizenship. So I'm talking about South Africa now, and I'll be talking about Namibia in a couple of minutes. In Namibia, or in South Africa, we had the townships and the homelands. In Namibia, the areas where black people are required to live outside the city are called, they usually call locations. They say that they live in the location. And areas out in the country that are set aside for certain tribal groups are called reserves. Instruments of policy for apartheid are banning. If a person is banned, it means that he or she cannot speak publicly, cannot write anything, cannot be quoted. It's against the law to quote a person who is banned. Cannot have more than one other person in the room with them, and are restricted to their house, except maybe with certain rules might be rescinded at certain times. Other instruments of policy. Instruments of policy: imprisonment and torture. These are instruments of policy of the South African government. I'm not sure I guess there are other countries in the world that use torture as instruments of policy. We understand it to be done in Iran, and it happens in Turkey, and it happens in Chile, and it happens, no doubt, in Guatemala, and a few other places. But South Africa is supposed to be an enlightened Christian country, using torture and imprisonment as an instrument. They have one of the highest numbers proportionately of political prisoners of just about any place in the world. But that's what happens when you have a police state. The political prisoners are those who oppose the apartheid policy. That's how you get to be a political prisoner. You oppose apartheid. That's how you get to be banned. That's how you get to be tortured. You oppose apartheid. If you do oppose it, you will be called a communist. That is the catchword, and it is used for anyone who opposes the policies of the government. Communist. I just want to tell you one of the results, really a sad result of this. In Namibia, it causes everybody to be suspicious of everybody else. This is one of the things that we really noticed when we were living in Namibia, is suspicion, mutual suspicion. Even at our Paulinum Seminary out there in Ochimbingwe, they all claimed, the students all claimed, and the lecturers also, the Namibian people said there that there is always a spy at the seminary. Every year, they said, there's at least one person who's a spy. We don't know who it is. One of the students, maybe it's even a lecturer. We don't know. But there is a spy, so you must always be careful. Well, I don't think Lois and I really paid attention to that at all. We didn't. It didn't guide us in any way as to what we said. We said whatever we had to say. And, of course, that's...
We're used to having lots, that freedom.
Yeah. Well, and of course, it's a lot easier for us, too. They couldn't imprison or torture us. The only thing they could do with us is deport us. And so that didn't happen. So I really question, what that does to you then. You start looking over the list of students and you say, gee, I wonder if that guy, he's a smooth fellow. Yes, maybe he's a spy, And it's a nasty business. This is what it does to you. One student we had who came to us, he had formerly been in the police department. And so he came as a student. Everybody said, aha. Well, not everybody, but some people said, undoubtedly he's a spy. Every once in a while he'd be gone for a weekend, and they figured, well, and he'd say, well, he had some cases left over that he had to do some reports on or something like that. And some of the others would say, aha, he's out getting his pay, he's out making his reports, you know. And he was only there for one semester. And then he left without notice. He didn't come back, and he never told anybody that he wasn't coming back. And so then everybody said, ah, for sure, this man is a spy. But then we also heard that he wanted to get back into the police department. And they didn't trust him because he'd been at Paulinum Seminary, they said. He's been at that hotbed of terrorists there. And that's what some of the police thought, that we were a terrorist school. And so he was suffering suspicion also from that side. This is a nasty way to live, isn't it?
Do you think, David, maybe that was for your benefit, that maybe that you would kind of be careful of what you said and everything?
No, not for us. I don't think so. See, this is just talk from the students. This is
they create that suspicion. This makes everybody kind of on edge.
Well,
it does that.
In previous years, they did have some bad experiences, and
right.
You know, when information was leaked out that could only have been leaked out by someone who was at that seminary.
Yeah, it happened.
When the security police came in and took some of the students and beat them up and stuff like that, and so, you know, they're just going to be cautious.
So they show that, I guess, I don't know if they've told this before, they show that in this way, that any time someone would drive on the campus, it would be a white person, and if they would just sit in their car and if they were waiting for somebody to come and give them some information, the students would very obviously, just that they're standing around talking, they'd turn their back. They would not pay attention whatsoever to such a person inside the car. If the person got out of the car and came over to them and talked, they would be civil to such a person. But as long as they're staying in that car, they figure that if he or she doesn't want to come out of the car, then we don't trust them. It might be, what do they know? It might be security police. They don't know.
And of course, sometimes the white people that are in the car, you know, they're afraid to get out of the car.
Yeah.
Because all these people are black, and so.
But they did have the idea, you know, when everyone wanted to go up to the north of the country, we had to get a police permit to do this travel. We had to go to the town of Carterbead, 40 miles away, to get our police permit. And our colleague went there to get his police permit one time, and they said to him, oh, by the way, they said, where do you live? And he said, I'm at Paulinum Seminary. And they said, well, aren't you afraid to be there? And he said, well, no, why should I be afraid? And he said, well, those are all terrorists there. And he said, well, he said, you know, I've been there for a year and a half. I didn't see any terrorists. But they have that strange idea.
But they gave him his pass, and then, because I remember I went to Carby with him that time. And the time we got back, they had called the seminary and said to tell him that his pass wasn't any good, that he had to get a special pass. And so then he had to go into Windhoek, which was 150 miles further, go to the police station there and ask for this pass. And the police there said, you know, hey, you're not supposed to come here and do this. You're supposed to get...
Supposed to do it in Carby, yeah.
But they finally gave it to him. But it's just, you know,
they do these kind of bureaucratic things. We managed to find out how to get around that. We found another place to go to get the pass where we could get it in about an hour. And, you know, these things can be done. Now the present political situation in Namibia. Now I want to go into that now. That's why I have these letters on the board. SWAPO is the recognized political party in Namibia, recognized at the United Nations as representative of the country of Namibia. SWAPO, by the way, that's not an African name. It just stands for Southwest Africa People's Organization. SWAPO as a political party was outlawed in about the year, I think it was 1966, and up to that time, it was like the African National Congress in South Africa, was simply a peaceful opposition party to the opposition to the South African government. But as soon as they sent them into exile, SWAPO immediately formed a military arm, and that is People's Liberation Army of Namibia. That's what PLAN means. And that's when the guerrilla warfare began. The SWAPO soldiers have camps in Angola, which is this frontline state here, just north of Namibia. And you recall that, some of you, that you saw the video that we had today. Ovambo people live both in northern Namibia and in southern Angola. That's Ovambo territory. And when they originally drew the boundaries for the countries of Africa, they didn't pay attention to those kinds of things, you know, which were the traditional territories. They just made lines and, you know, they were scrambling for colonies. That was in the previous century. So Ovambo people, they move back and forth, and they've been accustomed for years to move back and forth across the border there. They got relatives and friends all over the place. Well, now it becomes rather dangerous. One of the things that makes it dangerous is that's called now a war zone, and that's why you have to get a police permit anytime you go up to the northern part of the country, and you've got to go past a military checkpoint. They have enforced there, and it's been enforced, I think, for at least 10 years, a curfew that everyone must be off the roads by sundown, or they risk being shot at. And on that basis, South African Defense Force soldiers feel free to shoot and kill. It was on that basis that within the past year, the brother of the Lutheran bishop in the north, Bishop Dumeni, was shot and killed. He was bringing home some cattle of his, which had been stolen or something, and he found them. He was bringing them back, and it was over the border in Angola, and he's coming back, and he's riding a bicycle and herding his cattle, and it was early in the morning. The South African army claimed that it was before sunrise, and they said, so they shot him, because there he was. It was before sunrise. Shot and dead. And that's just one example out of many. Another of the political facets to this thing is that the United Nations now has, recognizing SWAPO and so on, has ruled that the South African occupation of Namibia is illegal. And that was ruled at least in the 60s again. It was ruled illegal. And then there came also in the early 70s a decision from the World Court, again saying to South Africa, you must take your occupation troops out of Namibia and you must give them independence. Well, there was an agreement drawn up about the independence of Namibia and so forth, and then the South Africans had practically been obliged to agree to the things that were set up, you know, an independent election and so forth, supervised by United Nations and so on. And then they got a new idea how they could refuse to do it. And they got the idea, I have to tell you, from President Reagan. The idea was, Reagan said, oh, you know, here in Angola, there are thousands of Cuban troops, and you all shouldn't withdraw your forces out of Namibia until the Cuban troops are gone. This is called linkage. This is the linkage provision. So then South Africa said, Namibian independence is linked to the taking out of the Cuban troops in Namibia. So they said, we're not gonna stop our occupation of Namibia till the Cuban troops are gone out of Angola. And of course, Namibians say, what does that have to do with it? Angola is a sovereign nation. If they want to have Cuban troops in there, they can have Cuban troops. But you see, the problem is, the reason they've got Cuban troops in there is because there are South African troops that are keeping on making incursions into their land. And so they're saying, we need a little help in protecting ourselves. There is, as you saw in, those of you who saw the video, there is a revolutionary movement against the government of Angola under the leadership of Jonas Savimbi. Perhaps you've heard of Jonas Savimbi. The very mention of his name makes my blood boil. That rascal comes to the United States and he gets wined and dined all over Washington, and he gets military and other aid for his for his depredations that he's doing, you know, killing civilians, men, women, and children over there in southern Angola. And we give aid for that. Our country does. Well, as long as this is being done, the Angolans are going to feel they got to keep the extra Cuban troops in there. Most of the Cuban troops, as far as I know, are back in the interior, in the center of the country. They're not down there at the border. The Angolans are taking care of that, and the Cubans are back, sort of like in reserve, as far as I can understand it. But that's one of the problems that is facing the Namibians. And they keep being told, well, we can't give you your independence until the Cubans are gone. Well, we all think, Namibians at least think, that if the Cubans ever are gone, the Angolans are willing to negotiate this, by the way. And the Angolans also are trying to maintain relationships with the United States. They're trying hard to do this, you know. We're giving them such a hard time. If the Angolan troops are, the Cuban troops are gone, we are quite confident that the South Africans will find something else, because they got a good thing going in there. They complain about the millions of dollars per day it costs them to keep their 100,000 troops in Namibia, but they don't say anything about the millions and millions of dollars that they take out of the country in mineral wealth, in copper and diamonds and uranium and other exotic minerals that they take out of there. There are other political parties also in Namibia. For example, the Damara tribe has its own party. They call it the Damara Rat, which is, I guess Rat is both a German and Afrikaans word. The Damara Rat has expressed, to my knowledge, at least a few years ago when we were there, we were at one of their meetings in the Swakop riverbed there by our Ochimbingwe, has expressed their solidarity with SWAPO. Another party is SWANU, which is Southwest Africa National Union. Is that right, Erna? Yeah, SWANU. SWANU has, I think, is divided into two parts now, and one is in solidarity with SWAPO, and the other part of it is not. And then there are the Christian Democrats. That's very small, unfortunately. And they're mostly white people, members of that, Christian Democrats. I think probably all white. But they are a fairly sympathetic group of people, fairly sympathetic, that is, towards the idea of Namibia's independence. But they're so small, and they don't have any clout, unfortunately. And then there's the the DTA, the Democratic Turnhalle Alliance. And that used to be called Deutsche Turnhalle Alliance, so you can see that the makeup of that party were mostly Germans. And I really don't know exactly where they stand on this business. There are a lot of the...
They're really, really conservative.
Yeah, but I mean, there are a lot of the German people, however, who are in favor of independence for Namibia. Although I think they would like to see the social system remain as is, you know, with the whites on the top. They would prefer that. But there are some of the Germans who do prefer, who would like to have independence. There are also a lot of Germans who are extremely conservative over there. We always remember the guy in Karabib who had picture of Adolf Hitler in his living room, big portrait there. And who he was the fellow who sincerely believed that the Holocaust really never took place, that was all propaganda. There are people in the world who think that way. They don't know what's happening.
Well, they would not be for, I mean, they might be for independence, but they definitely wouldn't be for reform. Or for an end to apartheid.
No, they would not.
They're more like the Nazi type.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty right-wingish. There was one store, they were even commemorating the formation of the Third Reich. And there was one store where you could get swastikas and other little memorabilia of the Third Reich in the town of Swakopmund. It's hard to believe. You know, we were thinking of putting a brick through the window, but then we thought, well, that's not the way to do it. Wouldn't help. Anyway.
It makes you feel a lot better, though.
we'd have got thrown out so fast you wouldn't believe it.
Those are the people that are against Namibia being called Namibia.
Southwest Africa. Okay. Now let me see. One of the ways in which the South Africans have of enforcing their security resolutions, as they call them, is this group. I don't know if I'm spelling this right. COVID? Did I spell that? Did I spell it right? Okay. That's the secret security police. That's like, you know, the KGM. KGB, CIA, whatever. That's what that is. That word means crowbar. That sort of has a nasty connotation, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And they're distinguishable by the kind of uniforms they're usually wearing. It's sort of a camouflage type uniform, isn't it, that they wear? And they are, for the black people, those people are really frightening. And it's really understandable. Those are the ones that'll come banging on. They use terrorist tactics. They will come banging on somebody's door at 2 a.m. and roust them up, take them to jail. That's the way they bring people to jail very often, that terrorist tactic of the middle of the night sort of thing.
And they also like to have their little roadblocks, which for us is nothing, but I mean, they're still going to stop you and hold their rifles at you while they ask you where you're going.
Wouldn't be so bad if it was a rifle, it's a machine gun.
Well, whatever, you know. But that's pretty scary. I was driving to Winnipeg one time and I had one of the lecturer's wives with me, and as soon as she saw those uniforms, she just tensed up. So it was just really terrifying for her. But, you know, they just go on as long as she was with me. They didn't ask her anything. They probably assumed she was my servant or whatever.
Otherwise, please.
I just want to say, it's a military police force, and the black people who don't have, you know, they can't get a lot of education, so they just have like eighth grade or 10th grade, and then they can't get another job with that education that they have, so they need to go to the army or to the police forces, and they are the ones, they are my friends and friends of others. They need to go into the police force to get a job, and then, and so they are the ones who oppress their own people.
That's correct. And then you see then what the South Africans say is, don't you see, they can't get along with each other, they fight each other. And you're quite right about that. And when someone is arrested and gets pushed and gets beaten up, the officer will tell one of the black underlings to do it. And this is, by the way, this is the kind of thing that is happening all the time.
Did you all see the video? I think that was brought up for good, like even in Angola, where when they would catch him and get him back, they all said, you know, hey, we're just about forced to do this, and
yeah,
we don't really want to.
Yeah, they are forced. This is a bad business. One of the things they like to do, they have a security resolution or a law that has been passed, and it's operative in both South Africa and in Namibia, that they can arrest anyone on suspicion without charge and hold them for 90 days. And then if they want to, they can hold them for 90 days more. And then if they want to, they can hold them for 90 days after that. In other words, there's no end. They can do it as long as they want without charge. And often this happens. It happened to some of our students that they would be arrested. I was speaking to one of our students, Andreas. If you see our pictures tomorrow, I'll show you his picture. He was arrested. They held him for, I don't know, several weeks, subjected him to torture. One of their favorite tortures is electric torture, where you stand in water and they prod you with electric rods. And he never knew what they had taken him for. They mostly say that, well, they're trying to get information. And they say, well, this person knows something about Swapo gorillas are in the neighborhood, and he knows where they are, and he's got to tell us. And so then they torture. Most of the time, the people, they don't know that. So he had suffered that. One of the other, they always talk about getting information. This made the papers even. There's one paper in Namibia which is brave enough to print all this stuff. It's called the Namibian. It comes out of Windhoek, a weekly paper. It's the best paper in the country. The others, they just toady to the puppet government. But the Namibian had this report, and of course we knew it also from people who were there. They took a young boy, a teenage boy. They thought that he had information. And in order to get him to talk, the soldiers brought him to their truck. They started up the engine of the truck, and they held his face by the exhaust until it was just burned horribly, and he screamed in pain, and he didn't know what they wanted to know. And so he, of course, had to go to the hospital. We had a meeting once with a number of pastors and with our students also, and our guests that time were two members of the British Parliament who were visiting us, one from the House of Lords and one from the House of Commons. They were the socialist members, and so they were, of course, they were sympathetic towards the Namibian plight, and they were meeting with us at our seminary. And one of the pastors told of what had happened to him and his wife. Now he was an older man. He's older than me, I guess.
Well,
he wasn't that old. Anyway, he was telling how they came and they got him and his wife, and it was at night, and they were taking care of an infant. I think it was their grandchild, perhaps. And they said, no, you got to go to prison with him. You got to go to jail. And they said, well, we got this little baby here that we're supposed to take care of. Your problem, too bad. Away they went. Fortunately, they had some good neighbors. But they took him to jail, and the man told us they made him stand like this in this position for hours on end. And then they beat him around the head. He said he thought he was going to die. He was there to tell us. And they kept him. They let his wife finally go home. And then they kept him, they moved him around, and they never told her where he was. And that's another thing they do. They don't tell the relatives where the person is. You can't go visit him or bring him something. And they kept him, I think, for several weeks yet after that. Maybe months for all, yeah. It could be for all I know. And and finally left him go. And there was no charge. But this is the way it's happening, and it is the leaders of the church who are suffering the most, because they are the ones who are very often most outspoken opponents of the apartheid regime and of the politics of South Africa. Another way they have of, they say, of trying to get information out of people, they'll take a person and hold them over a fire till he gets burns all over his body. Sometimes turn them over, and they do that to people. It's impossible to understand how human beings can do these kinds of things to others. I just don't know how they can do it. One of their tricks that they like to do is when they have had a little skirmish with Swampo gorillas, and they kill some of them, they take the bodies and strap them to one of their military vehicles called Caspers, and then they drive through the towns for all the people to see the bodies, 5 or 6 bodies. Recently this happened again, and one of the bodies at least was the body of a young woman in her 20s. And just, I don't know, they strap them to the spare tire or how they do that, and they drive around like that. And of course the people complain to the military authorities, and they say, oh, impossible, our boys don't do that sort of thing, you know. And that's what they say. But everybody has seen it, and some of our people have seen it. This is the kind of thing that is done. Well, I'll stop for a minute and see if you want to make any comment or ask any questions.
How flagrant does a violation that a white does, and maybe this relates more to South Africa, before they're banned?
Is before it they would be banned?
Banned? Does a violation they would do do you have to be a lot more flagrant than it would be for a black person?
Well, probably. It would be usually an offense of a different kind. Usually a white person who might be banned would be a writer or a journalist for his writings. Like, for example, the man who wrote the biography of Steve Biko, Donald Woods, he was banned.
But they would also be banned if they are in any way helping black people.
Well, that's one of the ways of helping.
Yeah,
what
I know,
way
but
helping?
I mean, you know, maybe if they would help them escape, or if they would get in, maybe if they're defending them too much, or if they take them into their home, give them sanctuary. I if they're just too involved in the anti-apartheid movement, they're going to be banned. They're going to be put in prison. They'd be tortured too.
That's what I wondered. How much this was.
Yeah, I think for them to really get involved, they put their lives on the line.
I think you're right, though. It would take a little more. I don't know what the degree really would be. And of course, we never tested that.
No, but there are enough of them.
But I think it's much easier for a black person to get arrested and without any cause whatsoever.
I was just wondering if the Indians were very sympathetic to the black cause. They've been in South Africa.
In South Africa, yeah. There, many of them are. A couple years ago when they made a new constitution in South Africa, they allowed for another parliament house for colored and for Indians. And so they have a house in which they can debate laws and so forth. The thing about that is that whatever they decide, the state president can veto, and that's it. So they have no clout whatsoever. But this was sort of a sop thrown to them. Well, many of them, both colored and Indians, said, we don't accept this. This is BS. We know that you're just trying to make us go against the blacks and say, aha, look what we got, and you don't, you know. And that's all they were trying to do, divide them up, conquer in that way. And many of them, both Indians and colored, simply would not accept this. And the ones who are in this so-called parliament, I don't know, they're probably regarded by others as collaborators, I suppose.
Mahatma Gandhi, way back then, had gotten some rights for Indians in South Africa through his peaceful demonstration. That's why they're, here instead of here.
That's where he began his career, in South Africa. Yeah, Ken?
I don't believe completely in an economic view of history, but I've often considered and talked with South African students about the fact that when you alluded to before exotic minerals, that's really the concern of the United States. The United States government, for all this talk about anti-communism and all this stuff, is really concerned about keeping the minerals in Namibia and South Africa flowing to the United States.
Right.
How does SWAPO and other people talk about the use of those minerals and how that would be dealt with? I mean, the minerals are strategic to the United States defense industry, the Defense Department, and a whole variety of things. And I'm wondering how Namibian people and what kind of arrangements could be made, how can we deal with this factor? I mean, I think a lot of the all of it's a smokescreen.
Yeah.
What it really comes down to is some really strategic economic interest the United States has in this area, and only if those are dealt with in some way will any change really come from the United States vis-a-vis Namibia and South Africa.
Well, first of all, as far as the Namibians are concerned, they'll mine the minerals and sell them. But the thing is, now they're not getting the results of the profits from it. It goes out of the country.
I think they would nationalize.
Yeah, that kind of like the diamond and copper industry. Those are the ones in, and uranium. I think they probably would do that. I don't know.
They would nationalize all of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that is in Namibia.
Yeah.
Yeah, about South Africa, perhaps they would perhaps want to do the same thing there. Of course, there they have chromium and couple other things that Namibia, I don't think Namibia has chromium. That's one of the
but
things.
But they think there is chromium, isn't there? I mean, there's a lot of untapped minerals that I've read
Yes.
Namibia that, you know, it's just waiting to be mined.
Right, right.
And,
I think potentially, yes, there's a lot more riches.
Yeah.
A lot more riches, and they're trying to get all they can out of it before the writing is on the wall, that independence will be in the future. We don't know when, but they're going to get everything they can in the meanwhile.
That's why I don't understand our government at all. Mm-hmm. Why we don't side with the black people? I mean, you know, it seems rather obvious that we will want to be their friends if they're going to be in charge of their country instead of fighting them. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
I think the reason is because the American government want the minerals from the Namibia, and South African government said that if SWAPO take over, it will be a communist government. So, and America used the excuse, and South Africa used the excuse of communism to get all the minerals out of the world.
Yeah, but our government should be smart enough to see through that.
But obviously they need the minerals.
Sure, but I mean, that's why I'm saying if they were the friends of the black people and helped them to get independent,
Reagan,
then they could.
They could still have the minerals, of course. I want to say a little something about that communist business. All of these problems in our world, Central America and the South Africa problem and Namibia problem, are always turned by our government into East-West problems. This is a totally false view of what is really happening. These are not East-West. You know, this is really, they are saying, this is really the U.S. against the communists in Russia. Not true. The governments that have been established, the independent countries in Africa there, are socialist governments. They are not at all communist in the sense in which we think of the government of Russia. It is not. It is a form of African socialism. They often call the Marxist government. For example, Zimbabwe is supposed to have a Marxist government. I don't know how closely they follow the Marxist principles, but I know that Robert Mugabe, the president of Zimbabwe, is a Roman Catholic Christian. And the same is true in the other countries too. So this is a bugaboo that they mention about communism, and it's just totally false, and it's meant to stir people up. And you know, there are a lot of people who don't study these things very much, and if you say communist, they immediately say, well, let's put up our dukes. We got to have defense against this communist invasion.
Even when we go around showing our slides and things, when we say that Southwest People's Organization, we just have to even say that, and some people are going to say, oh, communist. Just people's organization.
Yeah, when you have the word people in it. See? Southwest Africa People's Organization or People's Liberation Army. Oh, man. Obviously, communists, you know, obviously. Wow, how can you deny it? So they say. Untrue. I have to tell you that it's untrue. And I hope that you'll carry that home with you. When anybody talks to you, don't let them tell you this kind of thing. Is there anything else? All right, we have just a couple minutes to go.
We can hand out some keys.
Is so overwhelming, the stupidity of the thought that somehow you wouldn't try to maintain a contact with them, to try to work with the liberation movements.
Yes, yes.
And it just is kind of overwhelming how stupid it is.
I know, actually, Africa and the United States are the communists' best friends, in a way. I mean, if they're the ones who are helping to make communists, because everything that's good for them, they're told, is communist. I asked the students when I was teaching English as a second language, I said, when you get your independence, what kind of government do you think you want to have? And they said, well, for sure, it's not going to be a capitalist, but we'd probably go for communist. Because after all, everything we want that's good for us, we're told is communist.
No, the South Africans told them that.
Communist must be okay. So, you know, that in that way, they just drive them.
Here are some sources of information about Namibia, multimedia resources and addresses that you can write to. You can take one of those, and perhaps in your home towns, in your home churches, you want to have some kind of a program on this subject, or you want to inform people, or you want to write letters and so forth.
Here are letters you can write to your congressman.
Here we have strategies for action on Namibia. What you can do about all this, you know, you don't just listen to this and then go home, but prayer, education, support for Namibia, political advocacy, and economic pressure. These are some of the things that you can do. If we run out of these, there's more of them in the dining hall, I know that.
Did you bring the video that we had today, or was that here?
I had it sent here, yes.
Do you have ways that we could get access to that?
That'll be mentioned in here. I'll tell you where you can get that from, the National Namibia Concern. That
Workout.
Yeah. That would cost, I think, for a church, $10. So that's all on there. And it also lists the names of some of them.
What's that date?
Destructive engagement was that. It might even be listed on there. I think. Now here's some more paper we're going to throw at you. This is about sanctions against South Africa. Did you give that one out? Is that on its way? Oh, all right then. We'll leave the rest of these here, Jody, for later people this summer. You can make use of these, all these things here.
We also have this, we're leaving this book in the library, plus a photo album, the pictures that we took while we were there. So if anybody wants to look through this, they're welcome.
Okay. Any more?
You know, I don't think it's complete stupidity on the part of a lot of people. I mean, for example, there's a copper cartel that was going to be started. It hasn't worked as well as OPEC, but it's on its way, and I know a lot of American business people and State Department people that I've spoken with really has a vision of like all of the copper producing countries being another OPEC, raising the price.
Mm-hmm.
Once control of all of these minerals goes to other people, so the price is going to go way up if they're going to be accessible at all. And I think there's a real economic threat perceived here that oftentimes isn't dealt with in very realistic terms.
Could be right. Yes.
An economic threat to who?
To American business.
Yeah. Well, sure, that's...
Yeah.
For me, at least.
But, you know, on the other hand, with there are probably big lobbies that would be delighted to see the price of copper going up, because there are big, low-grade copper deposits in this country that aren't being mined right now because the price of copper is low. And people who have, there are big businesses who have interest in those deposits that would love to see that happen.
That's a good point.
So it's a...
Yeah.
But the copper, if I'm thinking right on this, the from Montana, the company there. I think they have pretty large shares in the copper mining Tsumab in Namibia, in the Tsumab mining company. I might be wrong, but I think they maybe own 51% of the shares in that company.
Could be.
And that is one of the worst mining companies in the country as far as
in
the treatment
Namibia,
of their labor.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And the safety, it's really...
Well, I mean, I still think don't take me wrong, I think we're stupid.
Yeah.
Sure. but some people are smart stupid.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the economy is...
It's possible to be stupid and shrewd at the same time.
Money's the bottom line for U.S. and South Africa.
Yeah.
And it's kind of based on a real... I think the stupid part is it's based on some sort of security feeling that somehow we're invulnerable to being threatened by third world countries. That's the way it's stupid.
Right.
I think this too. When you polarize a situation like that, where you say it's either for us or it's communist, you force a really kind of a polarized communist government on that country.
Absolutely.
Of course, them to look at the world in the same way.
Yeah, they say, well, now, gee, we can't get help from the U.S., we can't get help from people who are sort of middle-aiders, we'll have to go and get help from people who are,
right.
who are way over on the other yeah. side. And that happened exactly with Vietnam.
Sure it did.
Ho Chi Minh wanted us to help bring yeah. Vietnam from France.
Yeah.
Well, no way. France yeah. is our friend, of course. So.
Right.
Sure. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay.